Welcome to JW Community Podcast, where my mum is basically just blabbering on about nonsense.
Thank you, fam.
Hello and welcome to JW Community Podcast. I have got Lara with me, and Lara, we're going to miss out the usual chit-chat and cut straight to the chase. Can you introduce our guest, please?
With pleasure, I'd love to. And it's another accent to add to yours and mine. Mm-hmm. You've got the British accent, I've got the Melbourne Australian accent, and we've got a visitor who grew up in South Africa. So I'd like to say hello to Councillor Sisting, otherwise known as Angus Stewart, and I'll just ask Angus to tell us the capacity that he's interviewing with us. I just want it to be understood that you're here with your own opinion and not on behalf of the Royal Commission. So, hi, Angus. Please tell us about yourself.
Hi, Louise and Laura. Thank you very much. So, I was one of the senior counsel assisting the Australian Royal Commission into institutional responses to child sexual abuse. And I understand, of course, that it's work that I did there, and in particular in respect of the Jehovah's Witness case study that has caused you to be interested in speaking to me. And I'm very happy to speak about the work that we did in the Royal Commission generally and with regard to Jehovah's Witnesses in particular. But I must emphasize that I don't speak for the Commission. I don't speak for the Commissioners. I give only my own views and experience, and it's important that that's clearly understood. Otherwise, by way of background, I grew up on a dairy farm, actually, in South Africa, went to boarding school for 11 years, so I've had a little bit of experience in institutions. Pleased to say, no child sexual abuse in my experience. And I then went to university first in Durban and then for a couple of years at Oxford in the United Kingdom. And I trained ultimately as a lawyer and became a barrister, where I practiced in Durban for 15 years. And then about 8 years ago, moved to Sydney, where I practiced as a barrister and what's known in South Africa and in Australia as a senior counsel.
And well, we're very happy to have you in our country, I must say. We do like to take on outsiders as our own, and we'll adopt you happily. So thank you for being here. Angus, do you mind if I cut straight to, we've got a number of questions we'd like to get through today, about 16 of them. So if you don't mind, Louise and I are going to play ping pong a little and keep asking you question after question, because I know that our listeners will be thrilled to hear your voice. So I'm going to throw it to you.
I may find it awkward because I'm usually the one asking the question. It's obviously an interesting turning the table. Yeah. So let's see how we go.
Suck it up.
I might say I object to that question.
You can say that, but we're not going to take any heed.
All right. I know that you've forgotten some of what you did for us, and we're very grateful for that. And my first question is, how did you know about the 1,800 alleged victims that existed here in Australia, the child abuse victims, as part of the Royal Commission? How did council discover that?
Well, I got to know about that because I was told about it and briefed in detail by the wonderful team of people who worked behind the scenes and full-time at the Royal Commission. People who were often not seen in public or on the television or video casts and so on, but who really were the backbone to the work of the Royal Commission, some incredibly talented, committed and persistent lawyers and investigators. And in each of the case studies that the Royal Commission did, and there were many, upwards of 50, there would be a team allocated, and then they would work on the case study and often start just from the basis of feedback that had been received by the commission, complaints and so on, and then from that working out, well, this is an area that needs to be looked at, or this is a particular institution that needs to be looked at. And then once it had been decided by the commissioners to, yes, pursue that as a possibility, then they got going. And in this case, they, using the powers of subpoena that the commission had under the legislation, They then subpoenaed or compelled the Jehovah's Witness organization in Australia to produce their records of complaints related to child sexual abuse. And those records came back with, they were just astounding, overwhelming, with the number of cases, the number of abusers and number of victims. If one says nothing else about the Jehovah's Witness organization, one thing one can say is that it's highly bureaucratic and they record an enormous amount of information and pass pieces of paper backwards and forwards to each other. And that meant that all of the stuff was sitting there like a gold mine to the investigators.
I'm amazed that they gave it up because they've refused to produce documents in America and have been fined like $4,000 a day for refusal to produce. So it's just incredible that you got that information.
Well, we did have the force of law behind us. I mean, if any organization had resisted giving up the documents that we were seeking, there would have been consequences, obviously. But also, I think the Royal Commission enjoyed enormous public support and public credibility. So there's very little space for any organization, even an organization such as the Catholic Church, for example, that enjoys enormous influence in Australian public life. Even for it to have resisted us, or I shouldn't say us, resisted the Royal Commission in its requests for documents would have been very difficult just in the court of public opinion.
Yeah. I understand that you must have at some point been flooded with emails from ex-Jehovah's Witnesses, and I actually started feeling quite sorry for you because I felt that the entire global community wanted you to be our saviour and cult buster. But what did it feel like having to be a voice for the victims of the Jehovah's Witnesses?
I'm actually, as we sit here, I'm just looking up on my computer. I've lost some, but I've got 612 emails from sort of members of the public around the world. And it was quite extraordinary. I mean, during the hearings themselves, I was receiving a very significant number of emails every day and just didn't have chance to really deal with them because the hearings were so demanding. But even since then, every week or so, and now we're several years on, of course, but every week or so I get another email or two. Without exception, every single one has been positive in the sense of positive the work that the Royal Commission did in relation to the Jehovah's Witnesses. I can remember one email that was also positive about the Jehovah's Witness organization, but nevertheless sort of thankful for the work we were doing. But not one was critical of what we did, and not one said that we overstepped the mark or treated them unfairly or anything like that. It was incredible receiving all that feedback from the public, and quite extraordinary the following that this particular case study had around the world. Quite unprecedented relative to the other case studies. And some of the emails and so on that we received were very instrumental during the course of the hearing because we had people sending us Jehovah's Witness documents, manuals, for example, that we'd never seen before, that we'd never had access to, we didn't even know they existed. And then we'd receive them on emails, and then the next day we would demand that they be produced formally within the hearing, and then they would be produced and we'd be able to use them. So, amazing is my answer to your question.
We were so excited when that happened because we knew that a certain person was sending you documents, and then when you demanded it the next day, we were like, oh my God, he's read the email, he's got the document. It was amazing watching it unfold in real time. And in England, I know lots of us were getting up in the middle of the night to watch it live because it was so exciting.
Well, I'm glad people found it exciting and interesting. I must say the little bits that I've seen looking back, I can perhaps apologize for having been so dull and dreary. But that, in a sense, that's an important part of the work we do. I mean, not only in that case study, but in the legal work one does more generally, it's important to just stick with the facts and not get emotional and just remain very sort of logical and calm. And I try to do that, even at times I might have been absolutely seething inside, and at other times almost in tears because of these stories that I was hearing, but just sort of kept going in a reasonably unemotional and calm fashion.
That's, I was just going to say, you were incredibly powerful with your presentation. It wasn't dull, it was riveting.
Yes.
Well, thank you.
Can I tell you, I did some extra research today, and I found a quote about you, Angus, that labelled you as the sexiest man, sexiest intellect in the Southern Hemisphere. And I don't want to embarrass you with that, but when you say you think
well,
you
yes,
just
too late
dumb,
for that. Too late for that. You've embarrassed me already, yeah.
It certainly wasn't dull from our perspective. You were the champion standing up for us when we were children, and we so much appreciated that. I think that the reason why it was so positive was your calm demeanour, and your personality was so even-tempered that we were brought along on the journey with you, and it just gave so much courage to the people behind the scenes in our support groups. So I'm sure everybody would like to thank you, and I'll do that now.
Yeah, and actually, you have set a standard for activism among ex-Jehovah's Witnesses, because there's been a big debate about how we conduct activism, and to see you do what you did so logically and calmly has set a standard for other people, because it worked. It got what you wanted from the witnesses.
That's
well,
right, Louis.
Thank you very much for that. And coming back to the question of the sort of engagement, I mean, one sort of crowdfunding, this is a sort of crowd questioning, I suppose, in a way. It is also very rewarding just to, well, let me put it like this. I do a lot of other cases which are just disputes between A and B about money or things or something, and they're rewarding in their own way, perhaps intellectually, because there's some interesting point of law at stake, and they're rewarding also because one is helping someone in a particular predicament, legal predicament they may be in. But what's particularly rewarding in legal work is when one has the privilege to work on behalf of the interests of thousands of people, and then it becomes all the more so when there's feedback and people acknowledging and recognizing the work that's being done. And so thanks to everyone out there who showed such an interest and who followed it closely and who let us know. And I mean, I'm just sort of the person who's seen in the team, but there's a whole team of people letting the team know what they were thinking about what we were doing, and that's all very much appreciated.
Thank you for letting us know that. And actually, if you see members of the team, please pass on our sincere thanks to them as well. I'm going to ask you the next question, Angus, and that is taking you back to your childhood. It's like you're on the couch now. You're very passionate about apartheid, and I read that about you. I think it's in your bio. And so we assumed that that's what led you to become a barrister or to become a silk. Is that the case?
It is, actually. I mean, I think perhaps one should clarify I was passionate against apartheid.
Yes.
just in case anyone should have any misunderstanding about that. So I grew up in a sort of reasonably politicized critical family and went to university and immediately became involved in anti-apartheid student work. And at that stage, I wasn't studying law and wasn't focused on pursuing a career in law. But over time, I came to realize that law is a space, obviously there are many others as well, where one can fight against social injustice and potentially make a difference. And so that's what really sent me towards a career in law. And then I've always in my practice sought to do public interest work of different descriptions, as well as sort of ordinary commercial or civil work. So when I was phoned by Gail Furness, who was just absolutely incredible senior counsel leading the work in the Royal Commission, and invited to join the team, as it were, and do some of the case studies, I saw that as a fantastic opportunity to to, as it were, pursue that interest in public interest legal work. And the Royal Commission has been amongst the most rewarding work I've done in 2018 now, so in 26 years in the law in one way or another. So I did work many, many years ago in the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was set up following the demise of apartheid in the early 1990s. And there were some common elements, really, between the work there and the work in the Royal Commission here, in particular the idea of bearing witness to people's experiences and giving people the opportunity to speak and tell their stories of oppression or abuse, as the case may be. And I found that having had that experience in the TRC many years ago was assisted me in the work I did with the Royal Commission here.
Do you mind if I ask you a part B of that question, which I wanted to ask you earlier? But thank you for linking apartheid and, you know, the similarities between the work that you did with the Royal Commission. What was your personal view of the 1,006 alleged abusers that were never reported to police by the Jehovah's Witnesses? Do you have a personal view of that?
Do I have a personal view?
For example, well, I didn't watch every case study, but in our case study, I thought it was extraordinary that zero were reported out of the 1,006 alleged abusers.
Well, it was absolutely extraordinary. I mean, it was absolutely extraordinary, but in a sense, there weren't comparable examples in other organizations because other organizations didn't keep those kind of records or keep them in quite the same way. So it's difficult to tell. But I mean, one of the things that's really peculiar about the Jehovah's Witness organization and the way in which it approaches things is really it seeks to create and then perpetuate a very insular community of people where everything that everyone does is in some way under the auspices of the church. Or I shouldn't call it a church, but because I think they don't like to be called a church, but in any event, the JW organization. And therefore, any sort of dispute between people, I mean, between a father and a daughter, for example, becomes the business of the elders. And then the elders have a meeting and then they record what happened and so on. Whereas in other organizations, that would generally not be the case. It would only be if there was a, for example, if it was a church organization, if there was an allegation against a priest made to the church, that then one might find a record of it. But if it was an allegation of an abuse between just parishioners, that may never get to the priest. So in a sense, they're different circumstances, but other organizations, by and large, I assure you, weren't rushing to report their officials or members to the police either. And that's one of the things that the Royal Commission exposed.
I mean, that's why we call it a cult, because of that high control element over every part of your life and the fact that there's no legitimate way to leave, so that you're trapped inside. And in fact, we were blown away by your encyclopedic and detailed knowledge of Watchtower canonical law, for instance, the two witness rule. And we just wondered, you know, how easy did you find it to get to grips with that before you were demonstrably more knowledgeable than the governing body?
Well, thank you for that. Look, a little admission from my side. When I was first instructed by the team at the Royal Commission on this case study, it all seemed rather dull and bureaucratic. There were these manuals about you can do this and you can't do that. Report to this person or report to that person, and they all have these funny names and or designations. And I mean, right from the name of the governing body down, it just all seemed rather dull. But as I started reading into it and started to understand the incredible injustice that was being and continues to be done, no doubt, in that organization. It kind of lit the fire in my belly, if you like, and I just got more and more interested and more determined to get on top of the material. I mean, that's not different from other cases in the sense that I always try and get on top of the material, but in this case, I really felt a commitment to do that. And but that's what barristers do. We become great experts on some narrow slice of life, and then we move on to something else and then forget what we learned in the previous one, which is why you said so accurately at the beginning that I've forgotten quite a bit of what happened in this case study.
It was just a sycophantic comment, really, rather than a question.
That's right, because, I mean, I grew up in that, you know, I was child indoctrinated, and I've been really what's called binge researching for the last year and a half since I heard about the Royal Commission, and I could not do what you did. So the fact that you learnt it and have forgotten it is even more impressive, because there are many people who couldn't do what you could do.
It's true. I was born in and lived in it for 30 years and then binge researched when I left, and your knowledge exceeded mine. And we were all blown away. We're like, oh my God, I never even thought of that. What the hell, he said this? Oh my God, how come we didn't even see that? And yeah, as you say, I know that's what barristers do, but you obviously, you are extraordinarily good at it.
Well, you I'm very kind and generous, but I once again, I must acknowledge the work of the team, because also they, in a sense, I only saw what I needed to see. They were reading materials way beyond what I ever saw, and then they were able to then identify for me, say, well, look, you need to look at this and this and this, and you know, then I could really put my time and energy into what was relevant. Whereas in order to identify what was relevant, they had to read a lot of other materials. But also, I know they watched various documentaries that there have been over time about Jehovah's Witnesses that are available on YouTube and elsewhere, and they read books. There's a book by a former governing body member, and
yes, there is. I forget his name. And
the book.
Ray Franz.
I read that as well. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And but there are a lot of, they read various other books as well, and did research on cults and so on. So yeah, a lot of work went into it.
Were they all issued with sick bags when they had to do that research?
Well, I mean, I can say more broadly about the work of the Royal Commission. I think it probably affected in particular the people that work on those 1,006 files, is that they were given a lot of support, really for their own well-being, because of the trauma and difficulty of having to read those files and analyze them as to what had been done to people and how it had been handled. And the people who worked in the Royal Commission really needed and were given a lot of support in relation to that.
They were seeing that from every group, weren't they? I mean, I know we're just focusing on ours, like the world revolves around us, but they were doing that for all those different case studies. It must have felt just utterly overwhelming to them.
Yeah, as I say, they're just absolutely extraordinary people working there, and who were the kind of people that I really admire, because they're doing law for what I regard to be the right reasons. I mean, not to be critical of people who just do it as a career to earn a living. That's fine. But it's just so much more rewarding when one meets and works with these young people who are doing law
like-minded,
because they want to make a difference, and they want to use the law to work for social good. And now, the Royal Commission was certainly not doing it for the money.
Yeah. This is going to test your memory, and you don't need to remember the scriptures here, Angus, but in the Royal Commission, you discussed the two-witness rule, and that really introduced some new language into the community. We call it the TWR for short, so we've got a new acronym that we all know what it means. So the two-witness rule was discussed with the Watchtower governing body member, Jeffrey Jackson, who happened to be in the country looking after his father. So you read scriptures in Leviticus and you gave sound, reasonable questions to their application. But Jeffrey's reply refused to reconsider the way that they apply the scriptures. And then even today in the paper, you can see that Catholic priests, for example, would prefer imprisonment than to report child abuses that are given during confessional. So really we were pressing them to involve women in the investigations, and they still don't do that today, as you found out in Case Study 54. But what we're wondering is, and you don't have to answer this because this is actually you doing some work, but legally, what might be done to enable the presence of women in that type of situation, or to somehow limit the access of these untrained men that you questioned, and how they can access child abuse victims? Have you given any thought to what might be done legally?
Well, to a degree, yes, at the time. But, I mean, principally that was then the work for the commissioners. I mean, once we had all done our case studies as to what actually was going on in various organizations and how they were responding to the challenges, the commissioners then made a number of recommendations in their final report and included looking in detail at the criminal justice system, for example, and the rules of evidence and compensation schemes and so on, a whole lot of different areas. So really they got into that sort of public policy looking forward activity, including looking at the ways in which the law should be changed. Now, I'm not sure that they addressed the question of whether there exists currently in the law or whether there could be something in the law to deal with the particular issue you've raised. I suppose within the realm of anti-discrimination law, there might be something if it was made applicable to really private tribunals. That's what these are. They're not, they have the authority just by virtue of membership of a private organization. But they do mete out punishments or have the potential to mete out punishments that can be devastating to people, or not mete them out and equally devastating to the complainants or survivors. But I suppose the brief answer to that question is no, it's not something I've thought about particularly.
Louise, just to let you know, I talked to my friend, I've got a childhood friend, Stephen Unthank, and I actually asked him this question because I was interested to hear what he would say, and he had the most brilliant idea. And that was that the men continue to look after the religious stuff, but why not introduce the women to look after the corporate side? So, for example, the men can still do, this is not his words verbatim, but the men could still do, their judicial committee if that was, legally allowable in the future. But the women could do the work of reporting it to the police. So, you've got three men and maybe three women that work together to report it to the police and help to get a psychologist with the child. And I thought that was a brilliant idea. But anyway, we'll see how we go in the Watchtower. Listen.
I'll tell you my opinion. I have no interest in tinkering the canonical law of a cult. It's a cult. It's like, I don't know, it's like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, in my opinion. It's trying to make a cult's internal laws more bearable for the people trapped inside the cult. I would view it entirely differently myself, personally. I'm going to flip the questions around a bit, Lara, because I am not sufficiently knowledgeable about the next one to know what I'm asking. But I'm desperate to know, Angus, what you thought of some of the witnesses that you got from Watchtower. For instance, Monica Applewhite made me laugh so hard. That's my personal opinion. What did you think of some of the people that you interviewed? The elders, Rodney Spinks, Jeffrey Jackson, who we were all really excited about seeing.
Well, look, I'm going to be a little bit cautious about what I say about individuals. I mean, Monica Applewhite, in a way, was put in an awkward position because
terribly awkward.
She was asked to give opinions on questions without, it would seem, from what she wrote, being adequately instructed on what our expectations would be of an expert witness and how the opinions she expresses must be properly backed up by proper evidence and materials. And you can't just come and present yourself as an expert and say what you like and expect to get away with it. It's quite a serious undertaking to be an expert witness in an Australian tribunal or commission. But then, having been put in that situation, she did put herself out there, really trying to defend what seemed to me to be the indefensible. And her evidence at the end of the day wasn't accepted, so that wasn't surprising. I mean, the elders, to be frank, many of them I just found to be quite sad cases of people who themselves had been brought up in this organisation, and that's the only life they'd known, and that was really their worldview, and they struggled to understand the difficulties that we had, the people outside the organisation have with what they were doing, and they're kind of in the headlights in a sense.
Very much. It was visible when you were watching it. They looked. Then there was one elder I felt a huge amount of compassion and empathy for. I can't remember which one, one of the first ones. I felt that he had a little insight into how awful it was suddenly, and he seemed kind and genuine, and I felt that perhaps he might have been waking up.
No, I think that's right. And I think it is important to understand we're all the product of our backgrounds and our upbringing and so on, and that includes elders doing things that are, by any objective standard, pretty unreasonable and if not outrageous. But they may not be able to see that because of what they've grown up with and in. And so they deserve a certain level of sympathy, but then they need to be shown why it is that what they're doing is wrong. There's some others, for example, who were very, you can tell, very dogmatic.
Arrogant?
For sure. Arrogant as well. But also really wanting to move their way up the ladder within the organization. Very ambitious. And one in particular, one could see him being a future smooth as anything governing body member, because he just had an answer for everything. I mean, if you scratch the surface a little bit, you could see the answer was total rubbish, but he just had a smooth answer for everything that came his way.
Did you feel frustrated that there was no chain of responsibility? It kept going round in a circle, didn't it? Which you highlighted really well. Did you feel that the people within that chain suddenly understood that there was no proper chain of responsibility?
No, I didn't really feel that they had gained that understanding. I mean, perhaps I'm being unfair to them. Perhaps they did gain that understanding, but I didn't really see it myself.
I was just going to make a comment, Louise, about the governing body members. You might not know this, but there were 7 at the time. And let me ask you to guess, do you think the 8th member is a female?
Oh, I don't know, Lara. That's a tough question.
Yeah, give me a moment to think about that.
Can we get back to you on that one?
Obviously not, yeah.
Yeah, not. So I just want to take it back to where we are at the moment, and that is that the redress scheme came into effect on the 1st of July, and we're now in August, and the Watchtower still hasn't signed up. They were in negotiations, but we've heard nothing for some weeks. And what I wanted to ask was, how importantly did the Royal Commission view financial compensation? Because the victims, it wasn't important to them. It just wasn't important. They just wanted to be validated, really. And they got a lot of that. But we do believe that they should be accountable. And I believe that the Royal Commission saw financial compensation as part of that accountability. So I wanted to ask you about that, Angus. Redress from an organisation seems more psychologically beneficial than government-funded redress. Do you think it'll be enforced, or what's the main route for justice for us?
Well, look, just to reiterate, I can't speak for the Commission, and I don't know what the Commissioner's views were on these issues beyond what's in their reports. And even that, I don't remember in any sort of detail. But I can I say this, is that my experience of survivors of child sexual abuse is that they are affected by it in different ways. And some, and this depends, of course, on their particular experiences, but it also depends on their particular on them individually, and some are relatively resilient and, in a sense, are able to recover and get over it and lead meaningful, rewarding, and happy lives, notwithstanding having suffered at the hands of some or other adult sexual predator during their childhood. But others are, and many, many others are, really deeply affected for the rest of their lives, and it throws the whole course of their lives off track, in a sense. And as much as getting organizations to acknowledge the wrongs that they did, and also having the opportunity themselves as the survivors to tell their stories and to bear witness to what occurred to them, when that's all said and done and time passes on, they may remain relatively unhealed and continuing with their very difficult lives. And compensation plays an immensely valuable role in that, in assisting them, trying to pull strands of their lives back together and being able to lead or move towards leading more rewarding and fulfilling lives, and lives in which they reach and fulfill their own potential. And it's hopelessly inadequate, of course. I don't just mean in the sums of money that might be paid by compensation, but I just mean money itself is hopelessly inadequate. But in a sense, we don't have a lot else available to us as a society to do that. And the law knows damages by way of compensation for personal injury and in other circumstances. And it knows that that's not adequate. I mean, just to take an example, someone loses their leg, for example, in an industrial accident, and they, through someone's negligence, and they now sue for compensation. Nothing's going to bring their leg back, but monetary compensation may nevertheless make their life a lot easier relative to what it would be without that. So one has to really put all these things together and do the best we can as a society to support people who've suffered at the hands of other members of society. And compensation is inadequate, but yes, it's nevertheless very important.
Well, I think you're exactly right. And although we don't want people to criticise us saying you're only doing it for the money, because that's not the case, like I said, it's not the number one priority. However, I should add that we lost our families, we lost our friends, many of us lost our opportunity for education and for a fully fulfilled life. And so a $150,000 redress scheme per person is insufficient to cover all of that loss. And many who are, I'm middle-aged now, many who are my age can never recoup that, those years back from being a child to a middle-aged adult now. It's a loss of maybe 30 years in this position. So we certainly think it's insufficient, but it wasn't our main priority, but we really appreciate that it's been fought for on our behalf.
I just wanted to thank you for the work that you've done, because it's it's really had given a massive boost to all the support groups around the world, actually, and the XJW support groups that we offer to people, and that we've just had a massive, massive increase since the work of the Australian Royal Commission, and it's galvanised a lot of activism. So I just wanted to acknowledge that, really, rather than ask you a question about it.
Thank you. And you said to me that that the support groups have increased tenfold. I don't know if that's just an expression or whether that's meant to reflect a sort of accurate mathematical truth. But either way, I didn't know that, and I'm so pleased to hear that. I think it's just fantastic if the work of the Royal Commission has led more and more people to really see the limitations of the Jehovah's Witness organization and find ways to look elsewhere. And certainly so many of the emails I've received have been about that, people saying I was ignorant and now I'm not, and I just thank you for helping me see the light, as it were. And that's fantastic.
It's the first thing that ex-Jehovah's Witness activists mention around the world. It's one of the first things that they will say to help try and help people wake up. Because you interviewed Jeffrey Jackson, it's irrefutable. They'll say, just go and Google Australian Royal Commission. It's one of the first things. We've just had a film, actually, in our country called Apostasy by an ex-Jehovah's Witness, and that is fast becoming the next thing that's helping people in a broader sense. But the ARC is the thing that people refer to.
Louise, Angus just mentioned the support groups increasing by tenfold, and he doesn't know if that's true. So I had a look at the biggest support group, which actually closed down a few months ago, but there was one in America, which was called XJW Recovery Group 3, and they had, I think it was 12,000 members before they left, and they actually had graphed their membership growth. And there was an exponential curve. I mean, it was really, you know, a real arc. And, you know, I noticed in our local ANZ group that we were getting at least one member joining per day. Sometimes it would be five on a day if it was a Sunday and they had time to join up. So it's coming thicker and faster. You mentioned about Jeffrey Jackson again, Louise, and can I tell you, we now know the governing body members' names.
Yes.
Where we didn't used to know things like that, right?
No, absolutely. It was like the Wizard of Oz. It was like the guy behind the curtain, wasn't it?
Exactly right. And I recently went on a trip to New Zealand, and while I was in New Zealand, I saw some Jehovah's Witnesses on the street, and I stopped to talk to them about the Royal Commission, because you may know this, Angus, I'm sure you do. New Zealand currently has a Royal Commission, and they haven't included religious institutions.
My goodness.
We are campaigning for them to include religious institutions, but also in the UK right now, they have an equivalent called ICSA, I-I-C-S-A, ICSA, and they have not included Jehovah's Witnesses in that ICSA inquiry. So I was telling these people on the street about the Australian Royal Commission, and they said to me, you can't believe everything you read on the internet.
Oh, dear, and I said
to them, but I didn't read it on the internet. I made a submission on behalf of four members in my family, and they were gobsmacked, because it's not just the internet. It actually happened to us. So it's been incredible from that perspective. So I just wanted to let you know, it's a comment, that there were many former Jehovah's Witnesses that came forward after the Royal Commission had started that were not included in the reported documents statistics. So, for example, mine were made after these statistics were reported on. So there must have been many more child sex abuse survivors who were not included in the numbers. So the numbers are, again, 1,800 alleged child abuse victims, and there were more than that that weren't included in that number. That was the minimum number. So just a comment. Louise, I'll hand over to you for the next question.
We wanted to know, because we know we were just a small part of a much bigger thing, how did Jehovah's Witnesses compare to other organisations in terms of being cooperative and willing to change? Because we thought that we were the best organisation in the world when we were in it, just to be honest with you.
Well, look, if the one, if there's one incapacity of the organisation, that's with regard to change. It's more than any other organisation I can recall dealing with. It's incapable of change because it's so absolutely set in its ways and in its dogma. And of course, it has changed its interpretation of the scriptures, for example, on certain critical things, blood plasma, for example, and a few others over time. But those have been few and far between. And for the most part, it pursues this very literalist view about the scriptures, and therefore, it's not going to change.
And to be honest, they're damned if they do, and they're damned if they don't. Because if they change, people will say, well, you're not the organisation you profess to be. And if they don't change, they'll have this increased hemorrhage of members leaving. So they're in a very difficult position that they've put themselves in. Okay, my question is, what advice would you give to advocates in other countries who are seeking ways to prevent the abuse problem and to hold Watchtower to account? So let me just go back a sec. I just talked about New Zealand and I just talked about the UK with ICSA. But what advice would you give to people like Louise and myself, other advocates in different countries who want to hold Watchtower to account as well?
Well, that's interesting. I'm not sure to what extent I have insights on that, which would be valuable or beyond what you would in any event have. Obviously, where one can use public institutions that have the power of the law behind them to run inquiries or investigations and call people to account, whether that's in the forms of commissions or inquests or even court cases and individual cases, that can be extremely valuable. And it has, because of the power and the authority, and also because of the credibility of the outcome. So those things can be very powerful. But the principal thing, I suppose, is to, whether through that mechanism or others, is to keep trying to shine a light into these rather dark places in this very insular organization. And people who have never had anything to do with it might regard it as being a bit curious in the sense of odd, but they may see it as being relatively benign and really not have much interest in it. And I suppose I was in that kind of position until I started really reading in preparation for the case study in this case. And then I started to learn and to realize that it's not benign and that it's not voluntary either. And that's an extraordinarily important point to get across, I think, to obviously people who have been in the organization have left, they already appreciate those things. People who are in the organization may not. But people who've never had anything to do with the organization will almost certainly not appreciate that. And I'm not a religious person, but I appreciate there are some religious organizations that are sort of at worst benign or at best actually do quite good work, social conscience work and community work of various descriptions, which is actually quite beneficial. But in the case of Watchtower, really what they do and what they do to people is extremely harmful at so many levels, and one just has to shine a light on that.
You've hit the nail on the head there. I have a lot of people saying to me, what's the point of you doing this, that or the other? You're not going to change them. And I understand that, but I think shining a light and letting the general public understand, the more awareness you can generate, the more likely you might be able to effect some change. Now, I work with a gentleman called Tom Parry, who heads up an organisation in the UK called Mandate Now, and his big push is to get government to enact mandatory reporting in the UK. And he says that's the only way we will effect change, because you can't change the internal canonical law of an organisation, is my belief, but you can compel them to follow the secular law. So I feel that's the way my activism is going, to try and work to get mandatory reporting, but also just to shine a light. That's brilliant. Is there anything you think we could do not to prevent shunning, but to do, I suppose it's the same thing really, because as you say, shunning is the key. Shunning to me is what makes it a cult. Shunning is what makes it non-voluntary. That's a big problem.
Absolutely. I mean, of all the things we looked at, I found that to be the most cruel. If I just had to identify a few aspects of Watchtower that I found particularly disturbing, I mean, firstly, its very insular nature, how it's closed or resistant to any sort of outside ideas or influences, and essentially opposed to the education and personal development of the people within it. And that's all those things also serve to keep people captive. Secondly, its uncritical adherence to scripture and dogma, and making people subject to imposing male hierarchies with no realistic avenue to challenge the decisions and powers of those hierarchies. Thirdly, is shunning, which is just absolutely extraordinary and devastating for so many people. And then fourthly, I suppose one would get into the more specific child sexual abuse stuff, the two-witness rule, and so on.
Thank you. Lara, I'm going to let you wrap up this interview. You've got about 6 minutes.
Okay. Three quick questions in succession then, and then I'm going to introduce the song. Sorry, Angus, just as a warning, I pick a song at the end of our podcast, so I've picked one to encapsulate you. I'll come back to that.
Okay. I'm nervous.
Angus, I noticed in your bio that you've got a license to operate in three countries, and I think it was Singapore, here in Australia, and in South Africa. Is that right?
Well, just to clarify, in Singapore, it's quite narrow. It's specifically in the Singapore International Commercial Court, not more generally in Singapore. But, yes, otherwise Australia and South Africa, yes.
Okay. And so does that mean that you'd be available for hire? And what I mean by that is, if we had people in those countries, say South Africa or Australia, assuming you live now in Australia and you practice here only, would the lawyers that we're using be able to utilise your services? Is that how it works?
Yes. So we as barristers get our instructions from solicitors who generally have the ongoing relationships with the clients. So someone who, let's say, is contemplating bringing some sort of claim because they've suffered some loss, damage, or abuse, would go to a solicitor, and that's where all the preliminary work would be done. And when it gets to a point of requiring specialist advice or the preparation of the case for court, and then ultimately the presentation of the case in court, the solicitor would then generally instruct, or we use the word brief, a barrister to do those aspects along with the solicitor as a team. So, as a barrister, I'm generally available. I mean, there are areas of particular expertise which might be required in a particular case that I might not possess. I mean, I specialize in certain areas, and there are other areas that generally one can do. But I mean, there are other things that I would say, well, look, you should really get a specialist in that particular area, and personal injuries would be one of those. Where I, for the most part, don't do personal injuries claims, and there are some peculiar and specialist aspects to it, and there are people who do that kind of work all the time.
Okay, thanks for explaining that to us.
I thought the question was about whether it was available for weddings and bar mitzvahs, but there you go.
Now, Louise has forced me to ask the embarrassing question that I included. It's not been missed, Louise, that you forced me to ask it. But to get both of us off the hook, we asked one of our American colleagues to give us a couple of questions. So some of the questions are coming from her, and her name is Alexandra James, And she runs a website called JW Victims, and she also runs another one called Apostate Monthly. Now, she came up with Apostate Monthly when she did a gag picture of you, Angus, which I believe you've seen, and it was a mock-up of a magazine, and it had your picture on the front, and it said Apostate Monthly and a little blurb about you. But because that was so well received, people thought it was real, and it wasn't. But she then went on to create the magazine called Apostate Monthly, and it is now a real thing. However, you're not on the cover of the real thing. Did you know? Were you aware of that?
I wasn't aware of that at all. I may have seen that people did send me various memes that had apparently had been doing the rounds, and in particular the media unit at the Royal Commission sent me some of the memes, so yeah. I found that all quite amusing. But so I may have seen that mock-up, but I certainly didn't know that story about the origins of Apostate Monthly. So, that's great.
So next time we interview you, we'll say Angus Stewart, best known as father of the Apostate Monthly magazine.
Yeah, well, pin up, Louise.
Unknowing father.
Yeah. Unknown for anything else. Had an entirely indistinguished career apart from...
And I also found out just in the last 48 hours, again, doing some research, and you might be terribly embarrassed to know this, but I'm quite proud of the person who did it. They have tattooed your black and white picture, your face, on their shoulder.
Shut the front door.
True.
No, that is ridiculous.
That's how important that you are to our community.
Lara, are you joking?
No, I'm not joking. I will hunt down the picture and send it.
That's weird.
Yeah, it is weird, but I kind of understand it, I've got to say.
No, that's freaky. Oh, you poor man. I'm really sorry. Look what we've done to you.
Just a fan
Yeah, look, all I can say is the community of ex-Jehovah's Witnesses people out there, and I know it's a close and big and growing community that it's been extraordinary receiving the sort of feedback that we've received, and once again I was just the face of the team really, but there are a whole lot of other people who worked on this, and we feel your pain and wish you the very best, and just very glad to be able to play some small role in, as I put it earlier, shining a bright light into some dark places.
Louise, let me ask my final question, if that's okay.
Crack on.
Now, we've got three people represented here from three different countries. Louise, you're in the UK, and in the UK you eat something called Marmite, right?
Yeah.
Right. And here in Australia we eat Vegemite. You have to have a lot of butter and not much Vegemite. But I know that in South Africa they eat biltong, which is a type of dried meat.
Yep.
So, Angus, which one would you choose? What's your favourite snack of choice?
Oh, unquestionably biltong.
Really?
With no hesitation whatsoever. Look, I enjoy Marmite and Vegemite, actually, on the right sort of cracker or whatever, but that's fine. And, in fact, sourdough toast with Vegemite and thinly sliced tomato, beautiful, love that. But biltong, you can't beat biltong, I'm afraid. It's fantastic.
You're such a diplomat. Look, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's just amazing, the work that you've done, and we genuinely cannot thank you enough. Clearly, some people can with tattoos, but let's just park that for now. Sister Caput, would you like to introduce the closing song?
Yes, I would, and I also thank you from the bottom of the world, down under, and New Zealand as well, at the end of the earth. We're so grateful that you were in our lives, even though you know none of us.
Genuinely,
so thank
yeah.
you. So I'm going to embarrass you once again, and the song that I've chosen, I hope you know it, I think you will, because it's a classic. It's by Bonnie Tyler, and her song is... Holding out for a hero, and you are our hero.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. I think this is a bit undeserved, but
it's not.
Well, thank you.
But thank you so much for giving us your time, and I hope we've finished on the dot so that you can go and do your other duties today. And I'm just so grateful that you've come on the podcast. And I'd like to thank my three listeners for listening to this amazing episode of JW Community Podcast.
1, 2, 3. Someone reaching back for me, racing.